I've chosen to read this morning Ajahn Chah again from the anthology. And it's from the book number, volume 2, and which are talks on formal practice. And it's chapter 8, which is called Steady Practice. And just to put it, there's a footnote right on the title of the talk saying, this talk has been published elsewhere under the title Right Practice, Steady Practice. It says, first published in Food for the Heart, comment, given at Wat Kuen, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that, Kuen, to a group of university students who had taken temporary ordination during the hot season of 1978. But if I could just ask Lumpur to maybe clarify, because then the first line of the talk says, Wat Wanapotian here is certainly very peaceful. Is that another name for it? That's the same place. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Wanapotian is the formal name. Oh. And Wana means forest. Yeah. And Potian, of course, is Unpa Chan's Jokum title. Yeah. And then what Kuan is a means dam. And what it is a reservoir. It's about a when the the government built Sirinhorn Dam as a hydroelectric dam, then it backed up this large reservoir, and then a peninsula formed in the reservoir, and then the government felt that if they left it the government, then it wouldn't be protected. It was the forest was very beautiful, they lots of wild animals, and so then they asked Ajahn Chah to take about, I don't know, so they offered him about, oh, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 acres, and Ajahn Chah sort of says, oh, that's kind of difficult to look after. I'll just take 1,000. Which was the actual peninsula itself. As in the end, when Ajahn Puri saw was the... And it proved very difficult to protect. I mean, the villagers there were very poor, not very interested. So there was always a hunters and log poachers all the time. And then Ajahn Puriso, when he was there, actually made a substantial wall across that peninsula and really protected it. The wall itself didn't protect it completely, but it helped. And then we had the military come in to patrols with M16, that helps. But it went for years. So there's a lot, but there was always a lot of wild animals, different kinds of deer and monkeys and lemurs and I can't remember what else. Lots of wild boar. Cutest thing was, I remember living out at the out in the very tip of the peninsula, and sitting up there and seeing the, they're called mouse deer. And they're deer about this big, and they're hooves. They're so cute, and they're very, very shy. So that what could have always been a favorite place of Ajahn Chah's. So then when he had this group of university students come and ordained, and he had them go out and stay there, and he did the ordination and everything at Wat Pot, and took them out to Wat Kuen.
Okay, thank you. Steady practice. Wat Wanapotian here is certainly very peaceful. But this is meaningless if our minds are not calm. all places are peaceful. That some may seem distracting is because of our minds. However, a quiet place can help us to become calm by giving us the opportunity to train and thus harmonize with its calm. You should all bear in mind that this practice is difficult. To train in other things is not so difficult. It's easy, but the human mind is hard to train. The Lord Buddha trained his mind. The mind is the important thing. Everything within this body-mind system comes together at the mind. The eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body all receive sensations and send them into the mind, which is the supervisor of all the other sense organs. Therefore, it is important to train the mind. If the mind is well trained, all problems come to an end. If there are still problems, it's because the mind still doubts. It doesn't know in accordance with the truth. That is why there are problems. So recognize that all of you have come fully prepared for practicing Dhamma. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, you are provided with the tools you need to practice, wherever you are. They are there, just like the Dhamma. The Dhamma is something which abounds everywhere, right here, on land, or in water, wherever, the Dhamma is always there. The Dhamma is perfect and complete, but it's our practice that's not yet complete. The Lord, the fully enlightened Buddha, taught a means by which all of us may practice and come to know this Dhamma. It isn't a big thing, only a small thing, but it's right. For example, look at hair. If we know even one strand of hair, then we know every strand, both our own and also that of others. We know that they are all simply hair. By knowing one strand of hair, we know it all. Or consider people. If we see the true nature of conditions within ourselves, then we know all the other people in the world also, because all people are the same. Dhamma is like this. It's a small thing, and yet it's big. That is, to see the truth of one condition is to see the truth of them all. When we know the truth as it is, all problems come to an end. Nevertheless, the training is difficult. Why is it difficult? It's difficult because of wanting, tanha. If you don't want, then you don't practice. But if you practice out of desire, you won't see the Dhamma. Think about it, all of you. If you don't want to practice, you can't practice. You must first want to practice in order to actually do the practice. Whether stepping forward or stepping back, you meet desire. This is why the cultivators of the past have said that this practice is something that's extremely difficult to do. You don't see Dhamma because of desire. Sometimes desire is very strong. You want to see the Dhamma immediately. But the Dhamma is not your mind. Your mind is not yet the Dhamma. The Dhamma is one thing, and the mind is another. It's not that whatever you like is Dhamma and whatever you don't like isn't. That's not the way it goes. Actually, this mind of ours is simply a condition of nature, like a tree in the forest. If you want a plank or a beam, it must come from a tree. But a tree is still only a tree. It's not yet a beam or a plank. Before it can really be of use to us, we must take that tree and saw it into beams or planks. It's the same tree, but it becomes transformed into something else. Intrinsically, it's just a tree, a condition of nature. But in its raw state, it isn't yet of much use to those who need timber. Our mind is like this. It is a condition of nature. As such, it perceives thoughts. It discriminates into beautiful and ugly and so on. This mind of ours must be further trained. We can't just let it be. It's a condition of nature. Train it to realize that it's a condition of nature. Improve on nature so that it's appropriate to our needs, which is Dhamma. Dhamma is something which must be practiced and brought within. If you don't practice, you won't know. Frankly speaking, you won't know the Dhamma by just reading it or studying it. Or if you don't know it, if you do know it, your knowledge is still defective. For example, this spittoon here. Everybody knows it's a spittoon, but they don't fully know the spittoon. Why don't they fully know it? If I called this spittoon a saucepan, what would you say? Suppose that every time I asked for it, I said, "Please bring that saucepan over here." That would confuse you. Why so? Because you don't fully know the spittoon. If you did, there would be no problem. You would simply pick up that object and hand it to me, because actually there isn't any spittoon. Do you understand? It's a spittoon due to convention. This convention is accepted all over the country, so it's a spittoon. But there isn't really any spittoon. If somebody wants to call it a saucepan, it can be a saucepan. It can be whatever you call it. This is called concept. If we fully know the spittoon, even if somebody calls it a saucepan, there's no problem. Whatever others may call it, we are unperturbed because we are not blind to its true nature. This is one who knows Dhamma. Now let's come back to ourselves. Suppose somebody said, "You're crazy," or "You're stupid," for example. Even though it may not be true, you wouldn't feel so good. Everything becomes difficult because of our ambitions to have and to achieve. Because of these desires to get and be, because we don't know according to the truth, we have no contentment. If we know the Dhamma, are enlightened to the Dhamma, greed, aversion, and delusion will disappear. When we understand the way things are, there is nothing for them to rest on. Why is the practice so difficult and arduous? Because of desires. As soon as we sit down to meditate, we want to become peaceful. If we didn't want to find peace, we wouldn't sit. We wouldn't practice. As soon as we sit down, we want peace to be right there. But wanting the mind to be calm makes for confusion, and we feel restless. This is how it goes. So the Buddha says, don't speak out of desire. Don't sit out of desire. Don't walk out of desire. Whatever you do, don't do it with desire. Desire means wanting. If you don't want something, you won't do it. If our practice reaches this point, we can get quite discouraged. How can we practice? As soon as we sit down, there is desire in the mind. It's because of this that the body and mind are difficult to observe. If they are not the self, nor belonging to self, then who do they belong to? Because it's difficult to resolve these things, we must rely on wisdom. The Buddha says we must practice with letting go. But if we let go, then we just don't practice, right? Because we've let go. Suppose we went to buy some coconuts in the market, and while we were carrying them back, someone asked, "Why did you buy those coconuts for?" "I bought them to eat." "Are you going to eat the shells as well?" "No." "I don't believe you. If you're not going to eat the shells, then why did you buy them also?" "Well, what do you say? How are you going to answer their question?" "We practice with desire. If we didn't have desire, we wouldn't practice. Practicing with desire is tanha. Contemplating in this way can give rise to wisdom. For example, those coconuts, are you going to eat the shells as well?" "Of course not." "Then why do you take them?" "Because the time hasn't yet come for you to throw them away. They're useful for wrapping up the coconut in. If, after eating the coconut, you throw the shells away, there is no problem." Our practice is like this. The Buddha said, don't act on desire, don't speak from desire, don't eat with desire. Standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, whatever, don't do it with desire. This means to do it with detachment. It's just like buying the coconuts from the market. We're not going to eat the shells, but it's not yet time to throw them away. We keep them first. This is how the practice is. Concept, samuti, and transcendence, vimutti, are coexistent, just like a coconut. The flesh, the husk, and the shell are all together. When we buy a coconut, we buy the whole lot. If somebody wants to accuse us of eating coconut shells, that's their business. We know what we're doing. Wisdom is something each of us finds for oneself. To see it, we must go neither fast nor slow. What should we do? Go to where there is neither fast nor slow. Going fast or going slow is not the way. But we're all impatient. We're in a hurry. As soon as we begin, we want to rush to the end. We don't want to be left behind. We want to succeed. When it comes to fixing their minds for meditation, some people go too far. They light the incense, prostrate, and make a vow. "As long as this incense is not yet completely burned, I will not rise from my sitting, even if I collapse or die. No matter what, I'll die sitting." Having made their vow, they start their sitting. As soon as they start to sit, Mara's hordes come rushing at them from all sides. They've only sat for an instant, and already they think the incense must be finished. They open their eyes for a peek. Oh, there's still ages left. They grit their teeth and sit some more, feeling hot, flustered, agitated, and confused. Reaching the breaking point, they think, it must be finished by now. They have another peek. Oh no, it's not only halfway yet. Two or three times, and it's still not finished. So they just give up. Pack it in and sit there hating themselves. I'm so stupid, I'm so hopeless. They sit and hate themselves, feeling like a hopeless case. This just gives rise to frustration and hindrances. This is called a hindrance of ill will. They can't blame others, so they blame themselves. And why is this? It's all because of wanting. Actually, it isn't necessary to go through all that. To concentrate means to concentrate with detachment, not to concentrate yourself into knots. But maybe we read the scriptures about the life of the Buddha, how he sat under the Bodhi tree and determined to himself, "As long as I have still not attained supreme enlightenment, I will not rise from this place, even if my blood dries up." Reading this in the books, you may think of trying it yourself. You'll do it like the Buddha, but you haven't considered that your car is only a small one. The Buddha's car was a really big one. He could take it all in one go. With only your tiny little car, how can you possibly take it all at once? It's a different story altogether. Why do we think like that? Because we're too extreme. Sometimes we go too low, sometimes we go too high. The point of balance is so hard to find. Now, I'm only speaking from experience. In the past, my practice was like this, practicing in order to get beyond wanting. If we don't want, can we practice? I was stuck here. But to practice with wanting is suffering. I didn't know what to do. I was baffled. Then I realized that the practice which is steady is the important thing. One must practice consistently. They call this the practice that is consistent in all postures. Keep refining the practice. Don't let it become a disaster. Practice is one thing, disaster is another. Most people usually create disaster. When they feel lazy, they don't bother to practice. They only practice when they feel energetic. This is how I tended to be. All of you ask yourselves now, is this right? To practice when you feel like it, not when you don't, is that in accordance with the Dhamma? Is it straight? Is it in line with the teaching? This is what makes practice inconsistent. Whether you feel like it or not, you should practice just the same. This is how the Buddha taught. Most people wait till they're in the mood before practicing. When they don't feel like it, they don't bother. This is as far as they go. This is called disaster. It's not practice. In the true practice, whether you are happy or depressed, you practice. Whether it's easy or difficult, you practice. Whether it's hot or cold, you practice. It's straight like this. In the real practice, whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, you must have the intention to continue the practice steadily, making your sati consistent in all postures. At first thought, it seems as if you should stand for as long as you walk, walk for as long as you sit, sit for as long as you lie down. I've tried it, but I couldn't do it. If a meditator were to make his standing, walking, sitting, and lying down all equal, how many days could he keep it up for? Standing for 5 minutes, sit for 5 minutes, lie down for 5 minutes. I couldn't do it for very long. So I sat down and I thought about it some more. What does it all mean? People in this world can't practice like this. Then I realized, oh, that's not right. It can't be right because it's impossible to do. Standing, walking, sitting, reclining, make them all consistent? To make the postures consistent the way they explained it in the books is impossible. But it is possible to do this. The mind, just consider the mind. To have sati, recollection, sapajanya, self-awareness, and panya, all-round wisdom, this you can do. This is something that's really worth practicing. This means that while standing, we have sati. While walking, we have sati. While sitting, we have sati. And while reclining, we have sati. Consistently, this is possible. We put awareness into our standing, walking, sitting, lying down, into all postures. When the mind has been trained like this, it will constantly recollect buddho, 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 which is knowing. Knowing what? Knowing what is right and wrong is knowing what is right and what is wrong at all times. This is possible. This is getting down to real practice. That is, whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, there is continuous sati. Then you should understand those conditions which should be given up and those which should be cultivated. You know happiness, you know unhappiness. When you know happiness and unhappiness, your mind will settle at the point which is free of happiness and unhappiness. Happiness is the loose path, kamma sukali kanu yogo. Unhappiness is the tight path, attakila matanu yogo. If we know these two extremes, we pull it back. We know when the mind is inclining towards happiness or unhappiness, and we pull it back. We don't allow it to lean over. We have this sort of awareness. We adhere to the one path, the single Dhamma. We adhere to the awareness, not allowing the mind to follow its inclinations. But in your practice, it doesn't tend to be like that, does it? You follow your inclinations. If you follow your inclinations, it's easy, isn't it? But this is the ease which causes suffering, like someone who can't be bothered working. He takes it easy, but when the time comes to eat, he hasn't got anything. This is how it goes. I've contended with many aspects of the Buddhist teachings in the past, but I couldn't really beat him. Nowadays, I accept it. I accept that the many teachings of the Buddha are straight down the line. So I've taken those teachings and used them to train both myself and others. The practice which is important is patipada. What is patipada? It is simply all our various activities, standing, walking, sitting, reclining, and everything else. This is patipada of the body. Now the patipada of the mind. How many times in the course of today have you felt low? How many times have you felt high? Have there been any noticeable feelings? We must know ourselves like this. Having seen those things, can we let go? Whatever we can't yet let go of, we must work with. When we see that we can't yet let go of some particular feeling, we must take it and examine it with wisdom. Reason it out. Work with it. This is practice. For example, when you're feeling zealous, practice. When you feel lazy, try to continue the practice. If you can't continue at full speed, then at least do half as much. Don't just waste the day away by being lazy and not practicing. Doing that will lead to disaster. It's not the way of a practitioner. Now, I've heard some people say, "Oh, this year I was really in a bad way." How come? "I was sick all year. I couldn't practice at all." Oh, if they don't practice when death is near, when will they ever practice? If they're feeling well, do you think they'll practice? No, they only get lost in happiness. If they're suffering, they still don't practice. They just get lost in that. I don't know when people think they're going to practice. They can only see that they're sick, in pain, almost dead from fever. That's right, bring it on, heavy. That's where the practice is. When people are feeling happy, it just goes to their heads and they get vain and conceited. We must cultivate our practice. What this means is that whether you are happy or unhappy, you must practice just the same. If you're feeling well, you should practice. And if you're feeling sick, you should also practice. There are those who think, "This year I couldn't practice at all. I was sick the whole time." If these people are feeling well, they just walk around singing songs. This is wrong thinking, not right thinking. This is why the practitioners of the past have all maintained the steady training of the heart. If things go wrong, just let them be with the body, not in the mind. There was a time in my practice, after I had been practicing for about 5 years, when I felt that living with others was a hindrance. I would sit in my kuti and try to meditate, and people would keep coming by for a chat and disturbing me. I ran off to live by myself. I thought I couldn't practice with those people bothering me. I was fed up, so I went to live in a small, deserted monastery in the forest, near a small village. I stayed there alone, speaking to no one, because there was nobody else to speak to. After I'd been there about 15 days, the thought arose, it would be good to have a novice or pakao here with me. He could help me out with some small jobs. I knew it would come up, and sure enough, there it was. "Hey, you're a real character. You say you're fed up with your friends, fed up with your fellow monks and novices, and now you want a novice. What's this?" "No," it says, "I want a good novice." "There, where are all the good people? Can you find any?" "Where are you going to find a good person? In the whole monastery, there were only no good people." "You must have been the only good person to have run away like this." "You have to follow it up like this. Follow up the tracks of your thoughts until you see." This is the important one. Where is there a good person to be found? There aren't any good people. You must find the good person within yourself. If you are good in yourself, then wherever you go will be good. Whether others criticize or praise you, you are still good. If you aren't good, then when others criticize you, you get angry. And when they praise you, you are pleased. At that time, I reflected on this and have found it to be true from that day on until the present. Goodness must be found within. As soon as I saw this, that feeling of wanting to run away disappeared. In later times, whenever I had that desire arise, I let it go. Whenever it arose, I was aware of it and kept my awareness on that. Thus, I had a solid foundation. Wherever I lived, whether people condemned me or whatever they said, I would reflect that the point is not whether they were good or bad. Good or evil must be seen within ourselves. The way other people are, that's their concern. Don't go thinking, oh, today is too hot, or today is too cold, or today is dot, 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 dot. Whatever the day is like, that's just the way it is. Really, you are simply blaming the weather for your own laziness. We must see the Dhamma within ourselves. Then there is a sure kind of peace. So for all of you who have come to practice here, even though it's only for a few days, many things will arise. Many things may be arising which you're not even aware of. There is some right thinking, some wrong thinking, many, many things. So I say this practice is difficult. Even though some of you may experience some peace when you sit in meditation, don't be in a hurry to congratulate yourselves. Likewise, if there is some confusion, don't blame yourselves. If things seem to be good, don't delight in them. And if they're not good, don't be averse to them. Just look at it all. Look at what you have. Just look. Don't bother judging. If it's good, don't hold fast to it. If it's bad, don't cling to it. Good and bad can both bite, so don't hold fast to them. The practice is simply to sit. Sit and watch it all. Good moods and bad moods come and go as is their nature. Don't only praise your mind or only condemn it. Know the right time for these things. When it's time for congratulations, congratulate it, but just a little. Don't overdo it. Just like teaching a child, sometimes you may have to spank it a little. In our practice, sometimes we may have to punish ourselves, but don't punish yourself all the time. If you punish yourself all the time, in a while you'll just give up the practice. But then you can't just give yourself a good time and make it easy either. That's not the way to practice. We practice according to the middle way. What is the middle way? This middle way is difficult to follow. You can't rely on your moods and desires. Don't think that just sitting with eyes closed is practice. If you do think this way, then quickly change your thinking. Steady practice is having the attitude of practice while standing, walking, sitting, and lying down. When coming out of sitting meditation, reflect that you're simply changing postures. If you reflect in this way, you will have peace. Wherever you are, you will have this attitude of practice with you constantly. You will have a steady awareness within yourself. Those of you who simply indulge in your moods, spending the whole day letting the mind wander where it wants, will find that the next evening in sitting meditation, all you get is the backwash from the day's aimless thinking. There is no foundation of calm because you've let it go cold all day. If you practice like this, your mind gets gradually further and further from the practice. When I ask some of my disciples, how is your meditation going? They say, oh, it's all gone now. You see, they can't keep it up for a month or two, but in a year or two, it's all finished. Sorry, I read that wrong. They can keep it up for a month or two, but in a year or two, it's all finished. Why is this? It's because they don't take this essential point into their practice. When they finish sitting, they let go of their samadhi. They start to sit for shorter and shorter periods, till they reach the point where as soon as they start to sit, they want to finish. Eventually, they don't even sit. It's the same with bowing to the Buddha image. At first, they make the effort to prostrate every night before going to sleep. But after a while, their minds begin to stray. Soon, they don't bother to prostrate at all. They just nod. Till eventually, it's all gone. They throw out the practice completely. Therefore, understand the importance of sati. Practice constantly. Right practice is steady practice. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, the practice must continue. This means that practice, meditation, is done in the mind, not in the body. If a mind has zeal, is conscientious and ardent, there will be awareness. The mind is the important thing. The mind is that which supervises everything we do. When we understand properly, we practice properly. When we practice properly, we don't go astray. Even if we only do a little, that is still all right. For example, when you finish sitting in meditation, remind yourselves that you are not actually finishing meditation. You are simply changing postures. Your mind is still composed. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, you have sati with you. If you have this kind of awareness, you can maintain your internal practice. In the evening, when you sit again, the practice continues uninterrupted. Your effort is unbroken, allowing the mind to attain calm. This is called steady practice. Whether we are talking or doing other things, we should try to make the practice continuous. If our mind has recollection and self-awareness continuously, our practice will naturally develop. It will gradually come together. The mind will find peace, because it will know what is right and what is wrong. It will see what is happening within us and realize peace. If we are to develop sila or samadhi, we must first have panya. Some people think that they'll develop moral restraint 1 year, samadhi the next year, and the year after that, they'll develop wisdom. They think these three things are separate. They think that this year they will develop sila, but if the mind is not firm, samadhi, how can they do it? If there is no understanding, panya, how can they do it? Without samadhi or panya, sila will be sloppy. In fact, these three come together at the same point. When we have sila, we have samadhi. When we have samadhi, we have panya. They are all one, like a mango. Whether it's small or fully grown, it's still a mango. When it's ripe, it's still the same mango. If we think in simple terms like this, we can see it more clearly. We don't have to learn a lot of things. Just know these things. Know our practice. When it comes to meditation, some people don't get what they want, so they just give up, saying they don't yet have the merit to practice meditation. They can do bad things, they have that sort of talent, but they don't have the talent to do good. They give it up, saying they don't have a good enough foundation. This is the way people are. They side with their defilements. Now that you have this chance to practice, please understand that whether you find it difficult or easy to develop samadhi, it is entirely up to you, not the samadhi. If it is difficult, it is because you are practicing wrongly. In our practice, we must have right view, sammaditti. If our view is right, everything else is right. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right recollection, right concentration. The Eightfold Path. When there is right view, all the other factors will follow. Whatever happens, don't let your mind stray off the track. Look within yourselves and you will see clearly. As I see it, for the best practice, it isn't necessary to read many books. Take all the books and lock them away. Just read your mind. You have all been burying yourselves in books from the time you entered school. I think that now you have this opportunity and have the time. Take the books, put them in a cupboard, and lock the door. Just read your mind. Whenever something arises within the mind, whether you like it or not, whether it seems right or wrong, just cut it off with, "This is not a sure thing." Whatever arises, just cut it down. "Not sure, not sure." With just this single axe, you can cut it all down. It's all not sure. For the duration of this next month that you will be staying in this forest monastery, you should make a lot of headway. You will see the truth. This "not sure" is really an important one. This one develops wisdom. The more you look, the more you will see the "not sureness." After you've cut something off with "not sure," it may come circling around and pop up again. Yes, it's truly not sure. Whatever pops up, just stick this one label on it all. "Not sure." You stick the sign on, "not sure," and in a while, when its turn comes, it crops up again. "Ah, not sure." "Dig here, not sure." You will see this same old one who's been fooling you month in, year out, from the day you were born. There's only this one who's been fooling you all along. See this and realize the way things are. When your practice reaches this point, you won't cling to sensations, because they are all uncertain. Have you ever noticed? Maybe you see a clock and think, "Oh, this is nice." Buy it and see. In not many days, you're bored with it already. "This pen is really beautiful." So you take the trouble to buy one. In not many months, you tire of it. This is how it is. Where is there any certainty? If we see all these things as uncertain, their value fades away. All things become insignificant. Why should we hold on to things that have no value? We keep them only as we might keep an old rag to wipe our feet with. We see all sensations as equal in value because they all have the same nature. When we understand sensations, we understand the world. The world is sensations, and sensations are the world. If we aren't fooled by sensations, we aren't fooled by the world. If we aren't fooled by the world, we aren't fooled by sensations. The mind which sees this will have a firm foundation of wisdom. Such a mind will not have many problems. Any problems it does have, it can solve. When there are no more problems, there are no more doubts. Peace arises in their stead. This is called practice. If we really practice, it must be like this.
I find what Ajahn Chah reiterates about locking the books away and just using not sure that it resonates. At the same time, I see another part of myself that I trust less, but nonetheless has some volume, which comes from a place of like, I have to understand. I need to get the teaching down. I got to read a great many of these books. And this voice, it sort of points more towards the Pariyatti monastics and the suttas, mm-hmm. and this sort of aspect of the teachings. That's the dilemma.
Well, I mean, I think it's... I don't see it as a dilemma. I just sort of see it as ordinary. And I think we all have that. And I think it's important to have one, it's important to get that balance of giving yourself the time to practice, but then also giving yourself the time to do some fundamental study or to keep up a fundamental learning of the basic teachings, because I think particularly for us as Westerners, where we don't have a cultural foundation of confidence or faith, then we have to find that in the teachings, and so the suttas, when we go back and read the suttas, which doesn't mean we have to swallow them all in one go, but going back and having a fairly decent knowledge of the basic teachings and how the Buddha himself expressed them, then that gives a certain confidence, and then to apply that in practice, and on a certain level, as Ajahn Chah says, the doubts will not be resolved through intellectual knowledge. That's not the doubts of in terms of the validity of the teachings and the efficacy of the teachings. That's not going to be resolved through increased knowledge, which doesn't mean we shouldn't find some fundamental foundation in knowledge, so that we've got to have enough understanding of the teachings, so that we can have a confidence in the practice and a confidence in ourselves. And then that energizes the heart. Because often, I mean, it's important to investigate that feeling of not understanding, a feeling of lack, and how do we resolve that? Where are we looking for the resolution for that? And if the resolution is looking for some external confirmation, some external bit of knowledge or information that we're feeling, if we got that, then we resolve everything. That's an endless search, because it's what we're trying to do is fill up a fundamental feeling of lack with something external to us. And there is no end to that. It doesn't matter how much knowledge one gains. But the knowledge that we are seeking is the knowledge of the teachings and the way of practice that gives us the energy and the confidence to put the teachings into practice and gradually learn from that.
Or did you ever hear Ajahn Chah like change his tune at all with either Westerners or in any way around that? Like to say like, well, you need to study or something like that. Or did you ever hear him kind of see like that there wasn't a base or there wasn't enough knowledge or anything like that? I was just wondering if he ever kind of saw that in any Westerners or saw like...
Well, he never... I mean, the reality is one of the things, particularly with us, he never ever forbade us from... I mean, you have to take these are not absolute statements.
Yeah.
Then when Ajahn Chah says something, he's pointing. He's not saying there is no, and you know, he just doesn't work that way, and we take it as an absolute, and he never ever discouraged us from trying to understand the teachings. But what he's saying is, don't think that that's going to resolve your problems. That don't think that reading the books is the way to the end of suffering, because it isn't. It's really important to get the context of the expression. Also, Ajahn Chah had his own students who wanted to go and study, like Bariyati. They'd been in the forest monasteries for some time, and they didn't have a foundation. They wanted to go off and study. And Ajahn Chah never got in the way. And because he had confidence that, well, some of them, that might be their path. And for some of them, say like Ajahn Bunjong, Ajahn Nyami, we were talking about Ajahn Bunjong, and he went off with a group of monks. There's Maha Ian and there's one or two others, and they went to a study place, and Ajahn Chah recommended a particular place for them to go to, a very good study place that had a appreciation of practice, and then Ajahn Bunjong, after being there for some time, and he came back, and he's one of the really good leaders in the Sangha now. Maha Yin, who is, I think it's mentioned in Ajahn Chu's I think it was in Ajahn Kun's where he said Maha Yin, and that was before he was a Maha, actually. Ajahn Yin looked after the stores, and he helped Ajahn Chah a lot. But then he went off and studied, became a maha, and he'd come back quite regularly to Wat Pa Phong, pay his respects. So there was a court, you know, very, he had a very strong faith in Ajahn Chah, but he really wanted to do the Bharayati. And so he came back and forth. So I mean, there's, you know, there's just lots of these expressions. But you know, Ajahn Chah is quite, I think, quite rightly is that, yeah, the end of suffering is not in the books. The end of suffering is in one's heart, and you have to learn how to use both the Bharayati and the Patipat in order to shine a light on the heart itself. Because you can misuse the practice as well. I mean, you can, I'm just like, okay, steady practice. I'm going to do 2 hours walking, 2 hours sitting, 2 hours. And then I'm going to have that, and I've got steady practice. Well, it's a misinterpretation. I mean, it's not what the steady practice is for. The steady practice is for the steadiness of the internal quality of the one who knows. So both the practice and the study can be misapplied, misunderstood, misrepresented. It all has to come back to a freedom from suffering. What is it that frees the heart from suffering?
Well, this talking is interrupting my meditation. It's bothering me.
Yeah. I'm poor. Ajahn Chah, a lot of the other Thai Ajahns, emphasize this quality of sitting practice. Mm-hmm. And Ajahn Chah is showing that as the way to solve the dilemma of desire being both the root of all suffering and a necessary ingredient in being able to practice at all. And so he's basically saying that by just sort of making practice non-optional, like not something that's driven by desire, it's driven simply by routine or something. Right? Like this driving force is coming out of this commitment to be consistent, be steady, mm-hmm. whether we're lazy or whether full of zeal. Mm-hmm. And I guess I have this sort of question I'm working with. It seems like the main obstacle to achieving something like steady practice is the variability of that part of my awareness that is supervising what's going on. Mm-hmm. We call it the one who knows, right?
Okay.
When I'm sitting, sometimes it comes up and sometimes it doesn't. When it does, then the sitting starts to kind of congeal, kind of starts to do what I wanted to sit, like going off track, I can put myself back on track again. Mm-hmm. But if I don't have that much sort of self-awareness kind of going in the first place, I can just sit there and get lost all over the place. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes with walking practice, which are just the two formal practices. And then when it comes to in-between times, in general, it's even less likely. It's more likely that I'll be submerged under some distraction or some conversation or some other interaction. So besides just sort of knowing that this is the case and trying to strengthen that faculty mm-hmm. of self-supervision, in mostly that I do that informal practice, is there anything else that Ajahn Chah or others have talked about that would be particularly helpful for bringing that into sort of getting away from it is to get submerged by content and maintain quality of self-supervision?
Yeah, well, certainly what I found and still find useful is that mindfulness of the body, where that and not mindfulness of the body in terms of a focus of in terms of a concentration, but mindfulness of the body in the sense of a feeling sense of the anchor of okay, this is where the anchor of awareness is. And so that coming back into the body, inhabiting the body, and then paying attention to the because the body is like a mirror for the different moods and state of the mind as we're experiencing things. And I find what it does is give a sense of, okay, am I feeling irritated or anxious, or am I feeling pulled in terms of a desire, and feeling it in the body, so that there's a resonance or a tone of that's the body is giving me feedback back to what the mental state is. So then that helps to get this continuity and preserving that anchor of stability and clarity, so that there's an ease and a presence that is able to move within the transitions of meditation and engagement, or within the engagement itself, that there's not a not being pulled out, not being shaken. So that coming back into the body and using the, I've used the breath for so long that I'm, and also the kind of anchor of breathing and feeling from this area. So that's usually where I'm functioning from.
So what would that be in Thai term that I hear? Jit Gok Gai? Is that help at all?
Although I haven't heard it before.
Yeah, something like Jit Gok Gai, so yeah. The body comes in at the heart.
Yeah, it's like the idiom that she's using is sort of the mind sort of latches onto the body. So that's sort of like that. The mind depending on the body, so that's a good anchor.
Just to maybe amplify the state from a slightly different direction, the same question. Like in the Satipatthana Sutta, the first Satipatthana is mindfulness of the body. One of the examples given for like non-formal sitting practices, that he's aware when extending his arm and reaching and looking back and coming and going. Yeah. So that implies this kind of overall bodily awareness that's monitoring all these bodily activities. And that's truly what I try to do when my mind is being supervised. So that's the thing.
Well, that's where the steady practice comes from, having seen the results of when you, and that's where the practice is really a cumulative thing that is not just a onward and upward graph going up, but it's just these going. Really, weathering the ups and downs of practice and the delusions and fantasies and difficulties, and then over time, it's just as it's like the Ajahn Sujito he's always got an apt image, but it's just like. A meat tent, putting meat through a tenderizer, you just keep pounding it and it gets tender. It's kind of like that, this okay, and just keep working with it. Okay, and prepare for the meal.